You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Art Galaxy 2025, with illustration by Irina Kokoreva. The art world's constellation cluster is a sprawling place that's impossible for the earthbound to navigate. There are galactic fiefdoms, powerful regional warlords, orbital moons, and funky creatures lurking around every solar system. Luckily enough, our expert cartographers have mapped out the current contemporary pictures universe. Just make sure your seatbelt is buckled. There's going to be some meteor showers. Supernovas. The most powerful artist, Cecily Brown, Maurizio Cattelan, Peter Doig, Damien Hirst, David Hockney, Jasper Johns, Rashid Johnson, Anselm Kiefer, Jeff Koons, Kerry James Marshall, Gady Noland, Richard Prince, Gerhard Richter, Jenny Saville. Rare Comets, the most powerful collectors, H.E. Mohammed Hassan Al-Sawaidi, Sheikha Al-Mayessa Bint Hamad Khalifa Al-Thani, Bernard Arnault, Lonti Ebers, Kenneth C. Griffin, H. E. Zhang Feng, Lorraine Powell Jobs, Francois Pinault, Musha Prada, Mitchell Rails, Don and Mia Rubel, Jen Rubio, and Stuart Butterfield, Elaine Wertheimer. Media Shower, The Art Press, Ben Davis, Sarah Douglas, Andrew Durbin, Jason Farrago, Tyler Green, Jonathan Jones, Dodi Kazanjian, Tina Rivers Ryan, Jerry Saltz, Adrian Searle, Roberta Smith, Calvin Tompkins. Space Invaders, The Crypto Collectors, Beeple, Yusaku Maizawa, Maite Kovani, Mike Novogratz, Justin Sun, Gary Vaynerchuk, Cosmic Cantinas, The Art Bars, The Audley, Bar Oliver, El Prado, Friends Bar, Groucho Club, Lucien, Maxime's, The River, Rochelle Canteen, Time Again, Toklas. Centers of the Universe, the biggest galleries in the art world, Sadie Cole's HQ, Paula Cooper, Gagosian, Gladstone, Marion Goodman, Hauser & Wirth, Karma, Lisson, Matthew Marks, Victoria Muro, Pace, Perrotin, Thaddeus Ropak, Spruth Magez, White Cube, David Zwerner. Rocket Ship Britannia, the London Art Enterprises, Arcadia Missa, Bernheim, Carlos, Ishikawa, Pilar Corias, Thomas Dane, Pilar Ordovas, Raven Row, Stuart Shave, Modern Art, Timothy Taylor, Imperial Guard, the Auction Houses, Christie's, Phillips, Sotheby's, Black Holes, the Forever Closed Galleries, Bloom Gallery, Clearing, JTT, Kasmin, David Lewis Gallery, Marlborough Gallery, Venus Over Manhattan, Shooting Stars, the Rising Galleries in the Art World, 15 Orient, 56 Henry, Amanita, Matthew Brown, Emmeline, Sebastian Gladstone, Groton, Heidi, Lomax, Mendes, Wood, DM, Parker Gallery. Base Camp, the established museums and their current directors. The British Museum, Nicholas Cullinan. The Guggenheim, Marriott Westerman. LACMA, Michael Govan. The Louvre, Laurence Descartes. M+, Suyana Raphael. The Metropolitan Museum of Art, Max Holine. MoMA, Christoph Schei, New National Gallery, Klaus Biesenbach, Serpentine Galleries, Hans Ulrich Obrist, The Studio Museum, Thelma Golden, Tate, Maria Balshaw, The Uffizi, Simone Verde, The Whitney, Scott Ruffkoff, Galactic Smugglers, The Secondary Market Dealers, Aquavella Family, Brett Gorvey, Bernie LaGrange, Tico and David Mugrabi, Joe Namad, Sophia Pinsky, Vito Schnabel, Per Skarstedt, Christoph Vandeweghe, Michael Walker, Dark Matter, The Mean Meme Accounts, The Art Daddy, Art Handler, Art.net, Diva Corp USA, Jerry Gagosian, Tribeca Troposphere, the galleries located in the triangle below Canal Street, 125 Newbury, Bartholomew Gallery, Broadway Gallery, Canada, Chapter NY, James Fuentes, Andrew Krepps, Charles Moffat, PPOW, Almain Rec, Jack Shainman, Planetary Guides, The Art Advisors, Amy Capellazzo, Eleanor Kerr, Meredith Darrow, Ralph DeLuca, Benjamin Godsill, Kim Hairston, Sandy Heller, Jacob King, Todd Levin, Tobias Meyer, Alan Schwartzman, Planet Hollywood, the LA Galleries, Commonwealth and Council, Jeffrey Deitch, Fernberger, Francois Gerbeli, Hoffman Donahue, David Kordansky, Nonaka Hill, Reagan Projects, Mark Selwyn. from bust to bust. Andrew Ross Sorkin tells Natalie Korak his new book on 1929 works as a parable for today, down to the characters. Opening photo. Past is prologue. They didn't have DMs or cryptocurrency, but 1920s investors often pooled resources to manipulate share prices, much like the meme stocks of today. On a snowy day in January, BlackRock CEO Larry Fink joined Andrew Ross Sorkin on CNBC's Squawk Box for an interview in Davos, Switzerland, where corporate and political leaders gather for the annual World Economic Forum. While the segment mainly revolved around the BlackRock CEO's plea for Donald Trump's SEC to make it harder for activist shareholders to take on corporations via proxy vote, Sorkin couldn't resist asking for Fink's take on the booming cryptocurrency ecosystem. Are you planning on issuing either a meme coin, ETFs, or anything like that, now that the animal spirits seem to be very much alive? He asked. I think the Sorkin coin, Fink replied. 2 hours later, Sorkin was watching the brand new cryptocurrency, minted by some enterprising meme coiner, soar by millions of dollars. It was wild, he recalls. At the time, Sorkin was finishing his latest book, 1929, Inside the Greatest Crash in History and How It Shattered a Nation, an extensive account of how Wall Street and the U.S. government dragged the country into the Great Depression. Several months later, over a late summer coffee, Sorkin and I are discussing the history of the economic collapse and the book itself, in which the parallels to today exist almost down to the person, Fink included, sort of. More on that below. I ask whether the popular 1920s-era stock pooling practice among Wall Street insiders, where powerful investors combined their resources and artificially ran up the stock price of a given company, bore any similarity to modern-day meme stocks, as online communities drive stock purchases leading to rapid price oscillation. Completely, Sorkin replies, adding that it's happening in both meme stock culture and the world of crypto. So what's the contemporary analog to the old stock pool? I think Reddit, Sorkin says. After his own crypto coin hit the market in January, Sorkin was invited to direct messaging groups of that nature on X and Signal. They're talking about, I'm going to buy in at this, and then you're going to do this. I'm going to put up $2 million, then you're going to put up $1 million. And it's up and up and up and up, he tells me of the group's members. It's totally crazy, he says. Sorkin argues that technology has allowed for more democracy, as the 1920s backrooms were invite-only. Restricted to those with deep pockets and established Wall Street connections. But it's entirely possible if that were the case today, Sorkin would still find a way to observe and report. The New York Times financial columnist and CNBC anchor occupies a high-profile role in business media, where he threads the needle between reporting on powerful figures and companies while maintaining exclusive access to leaders at Davos, and his standing invitation to Allen and Company's strictly off-the-record Sun Valley conference. His previous book, 2009's Too Big to Fail, became one of the definitive accounts of the 2008 financial crisis. Sorkin parlayed it into an HBO movie and had a prestige TV side hustle, co-creating Showtime's Billions. For his latest literary undertaking, Sorkin explores The Big One and how it took shape on Wall Street, while the government maintained an unwillingness to interfere, and prematurely stem foul play from taking root under the guise of the democratization of the stock market. But did the most infamous economic collapse in American history which isn't lacking in extensive coverage from journalists, historians, and economists alike, need Sorkin's take? His proposition is that there might not be a single journalist with a better understanding of how the economy is currently being reshaped by key players adopting modern finance technology under a similar pretense of accessibility. And they might eventually have the same power to shove America off the cliff. The spine of the story in Sorkin's telling centers on Charles Mitchell, National City Bank president and board member of the New York Federal Reserve, and Virginia Senator Carter Glass, who constantly declared war on Wall Street, attempting to warn the rest of the government and the public of the perilous trajectory the U.S. was headed on. Sorkin would compare Mitchell to the modern-day CEO and chairman of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, in terms of status. But his mien was more an amalgam of Apollo Global Management CEO Mark Rowan, Coinbase CEO Brian Armstrong, and BlackRock Sphinx. Those three people at the moment are reinventing Wall Street and modern finance, Sorkin explains. Mitchell might have been just as ubiquitous as Dimon, fronting the covers of business publications, which frequently touted his Bank for All program, an effort to make the financial industry accessible. Sorkin views various instruments from BlackRock, Coinbase, and Apollo in a similar vein. Glass, the rain cloud to Mitchell's Sunshine Charlie media persona, would be represented by today's Elizabeth Warren or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Well, except that he's racist, Sorkin adds. Another character parallel was the restless John Rescob, who became one of the wealthiest men in the country by revolutionizing the automobile industry. Money alone failed to satisfy him, so Rescob got involved in politics, where he was despised, wrongly assuming that his wealth could be weaponized for political purposes. And in his downtime, he sired 13 children. Sound familiar? He's the Elon Musk of Sorkin's narrative. Both men were seemingly never satisfied, Sorkin says. Then there is the stock trader Jesse Livermore, who was able to maintain his allure in the press by planting stories and issuing elaborate denials to provocative questions, even though he squandered several fortunes. The first comparison that came to mind was Billions' Bobby Axelrod, who manages a multi-billion-dollar hedge fund. He also compares Livermore to Bill Ackman, the Pershing Square Capital Management CEO, who has become a media constant over the last few years. Throughout the book, Sorkin chronicles the attempts of these business leaders to move the markets, both for personal financial gain and to reassure the public that there was nothing to worry about as the house of cards started to collapse. Most of the financial coverage at the time was relatively obsequious, Sorkin tells me, adding that investigative journalism in the sector was uncommon, given the novelty of burgeoning Wall Street celebrity. The shine wore off around 1931, but it was too late for warnings by that point. Sorkin argues that by 2008, journalists had started to learn from their mistakes, setting off alarms for years of a real estate bubble that could burst at any moment. But he says, by default, if our job is to blow the whistle, you can argue we didn't blow it loud enough. Even still, CEOs and business leaders use the media as a tool to move the markets and cozy up to journalists. Sorkin acknowledges that he encounters this frequently, given his platform. Fink may have been doing something like that with his Davos Squawk Box appearance, signaling his hopes for Trump's SEC. It's something of a trade hazard when the president is a well-known cable news obsessive. If the question is whether the U.S. is walking into another financial crisis like 1929 and the Great Depression, Sorkin isn't ready to draw that conclusion. Most financial crises are a function of debt and too much leverage in the markets, he continues. And part of the problem is we don't know whether there is, because so much of the leverage in the system now is now in sort of the shadow banking system. The events of 1929 should serve as a warning, not that we are necessarily on the cusp of a financial crisis of that magnitude, Sorkin argues, but that if lessons aren't learned, we could go down the same road. And as any crypto investor who may have been put on to Sorkin Coin via stock pool-esque group chat by now surely knows, nothing good lasts forever. At press time, the unit was trading at 0.0008786 of a dollar. on to media studies. He got his MTV. Tom Freston helped birth MTV and reinvent television. In an excerpt from his new memoir, Unplugged, Adventures from MTV to Timbuktu, he recalls the campaign that saved the network. By the summer of 1982, MTV was in desperate straits. We were still big in Oklahoma, but few other cable companies were adding MTV to their lineups. In American business, if you ain't growing, you're dying. We were in danger of being shut down if we couldn't convince more cable guys to carry us before the money ran out. Enter George Lois and Dale Pun, a wild-eyed, smiling but scary-looking dude whose specialty was media promotion, which involved banging people over the head repeatedly with a simple idea, such as love songs, nothing but love songs, WPIX-FM. Years earlier, Lois had overseen an ad campaign for an oatmeal brand that enlisted Mickey Mantle and Wilt Chamberlain to cry on camera and whine, "I want my Maypo!" It was ironic. It was satiric. It was bold. It was ridiculous. It was advertising that became more famous than the product. Pon and Lois were hired to help us beat the Reaper. "Let's rip off my old Maypo campaign," Lois said. "I want my MTV. F these cable guys. You gotta go for broke." Being solicitous of the cable operators had gotten us nowhere. The next step was to get legions of spoiled young adult baby boomers to demand their MTV just like they had once demanded their Maypo. So was born the campaign, "I Want My MTV." Now we had to identify which stars were the rock and roll equivalents of Mickey Mantle and Wilt the Stilt. Lois answered that immediately. "You need to get Mick Jagger. He's the biggest star in the world." "Sure, George. No problem." We had learned some lessons about big stars and MTV. Early on, we had struggled to get permission even to use photos of recording artists. And the opening illustration shows some of those photos of recording artists at that time. My partner John Sykes and I realized we were asking the wrong people. To the record labels, we might as well have been a high school fan club asking for free pictures. They were oriented toward radio and print, not TV. It was worse when we tried to go through the lawyers. They said no as a policy. It seemed to defy logic, but we found that the easiest people to deal with were the hardest people to get to, the artist themselves. We went off like bounty hunters to bag our targets. Sykes's mission was Pete Townsend. Les Garland, our hilarious new larger-than-life head of programming, went for Mick Jagger, whom he had met before. I drew David Bowie. This was our Hail Mary shot. Next photo, Starman. In the early 1980s, MTV struggled to break into even mid-size cable markets. Then it landed David Bowie and Mick Jagger and Pete Townsend for a watershed ad campaign. Sykes waited for hours outside Townsend's manager's London office. When Townsend showed up, Sykes went into his boyish, charismatic mode. "Hi, Pete, I'm John Sykes. I'm with MTV. It's a new channel that plays music videos. Would you do a promo for us like you do when you visit radio stations?" Townsend probably assumed his manager had set this up. He asked Sykes when he wanted to do it. "How about right now?" Pon had rented a garage across the street and had his camera set up. Sykes led Townsend over. It took only a few minutes. Garland took Pon and a video crew to Paris to stalk the Rolling Stone. When he finally appeared, Garland was on him with the full hustle of a seasoned radio veteran. Jagger remembered him. "All you need to say is, 'I want my MTV,'" Garland said. "You want me to do a commercial?" said Jagger. "It's really more of an endorsement. an endorsement for a new phenomenon called music videos. Yeah, that's a commercial. The Rolling Stones don't do commercials. Mick, we don't have any money, but if this is about money, I'll give you a dollar. Garland laid a dollar on the table. It could have gone either way, but Jagger laughed. Then he said, I like you, Garland. I'll do it. Jagger told them to come back the next day. They did. He gave them 5 minutes, during which he said, I want my MTV a few times, giving it the weight of I can't get no satisfaction. Bowie had a very pleasant, somewhat mysterious associate named Coco Schwab. Managers came and went. Record labels came and went, but Schwab was constant. I called her. Would David be willing to do an I Want My MTV commercial? She responded a day later. He'd really love to, but David's skiing in Gstaad in Switzerland right now. He's on vacation. He'll do it on skis, on the slopes there, if you want. Are you up for a little trip? It'll be fun. Was I up for that little trip? We were operating like Mission Impossible. Along with Pon and his crew, I took a plane to Zurich, then a train, and wound through the snowy Alps to Posh Gstaad with a full load of heavy 35mm gear. Schwab had us carry everything out into the snow and set up at the bottom of a remote hill. Bowie skied down in great spirits. He was in his slick Let's Dance phase. On the slopes, he looked like a surfer with blonde hair, dressed in a slim parka and shades. He directed himself for the spot. He wanted to ski down, swoosh at the bottom, rip off his sunglasses, and with a broad grin say, I want my MTV. He thought it would be fun to put our logo on his skis, too, in post-production. We got the spot in a few takes. Mission accomplished. When we finished, Bowie asked if any of us wanted to ski with him. I am rarely starstruck by artist Bowie, though. Bowie and the Beatles had a special aura for me, head and shoulders over everyone else. Bowie made it easy in the Alps. He talked about books more than music. He asked about my background. I got some laughs out of him. I knew a girl who worked for him, who dated my brother. That was another icebreaker. Later, when the sun was dropping, Bowie said, Hey, Tom, how about a sauna later to relax? Top off the day. Come meet me at the Palace Hotel. The Gstaad Palace was the epicenter of Gstaad High Society, the towering five-star Grand Dame Hotel in the valley. I rushed back to our hotel, a Spartan lodge, barely a cut above a youth hostel. You're not going to believe this, but Bowie just invited me to take a sauna with him at the Palace Hotel. See you losers later, I told the crew. Bowie was waiting in the spa. We walked together into the sauna. There was only one other person there. He was sitting on a high bench up in the back, deep in the fog. I squinted. It was Paul McCartney. Jesus Christ. Somehow, I'd made it into the sauna of the stars. Bowie and McCartney and Tommy Freston from Connecticut sat around naked, wrapped in towels, taking turns throwing water on the hot rocks. We shot the shit for half an hour. They were easy to talk to and eager to hear about MTV. I was full of gratitude. Jagger's in, we told Pat Benatar. That was all she needed to know. Same with the police. Our storyboard had Sting swinging a telephone receiver around like a madman, almost jumping off the screen and shouting, America! Call your cable company and demand your MTV! I helped round up Billy Idol, Cyndi Lauper, Hall & Oates, and others. I traveled with Pon and his camera crew all over the world. After a while, artists were calling us, asking to be in the spots. I Want My MTV became one of the most effective ad campaigns of all time. It saved us. It transformed us. After a 3-week barrage, without fail, each cable operator in a market we targeted raised a white flag and signed up. We added more than 1 million new homes every month for more than 2 years. I had a map in the office to help us plot our next attack. In the end, we closed in on the two major media markets, New York and Los Angeles. This was where the influencers, the opinion makers, the critics, the advertising agencies, the magazine editors, and most importantly, our employees lived. In rock and roll, it takes a long time and a lot of work to become an overnight sensation. All of America got its MTV. Then the entire world got it. Excerpted from Unplugged, Adventures from MTV to Timbuktu by Tom Freston, copyright 2025 by Tom Freston, reprinted by permission of Gallery Books, an imprint of Simon & Schuster. realm of the coin, in a financial system upended by cryptocurrencies and meme stocks, where value is detached from utility and the loudest voice gets richest, Zoe Bernard tours a brave new world in Bel Air that is part Bravo Liberty, part Wolf of Wall Street, and all casino. With photographs by Michelle Grosskopf. The meme generation, chasing the jackpot or planning the next party by the pool at Meme House LA, where two internet species, meme coin traders and influencers, come together. On a recent afternoon in otherwise sleepy Bel Air, where multi-million-dollar mansions disappear behind walls of tangled bougainvillea, two security guards, handguns at their hips, pace before a tall black gate, keeping watch over a cutting-edge social experiment. The marriage of influencer culture and meme coin speculation. Inside, caterers pass out coconuts to Love Island cast members who lounge in glittering bikinis, prepping to film sponsored content. Everyone is beautiful, bronzed, and carefully composed for the camera. At the head of a long table sits Jade Watson, a red-headed content producer, drafting a Prediction Markets for Dummies campaign based on the long-term romantic prospects of the reality show's couples. Buy, hold, or sell. What we're doing is simplifying trading terms, Watson says, but we're using the language Gen Z already speaks. Downstairs, in a room of wall-to-wall windows, overlooking dusty canyons, sloping out to the Los Angeles skyline, four traders sit before massive monitors. The screens are filled with charts and numbers. It looks like a tiny Wall Street trading floor with a patio bar and infinity pool attached. Webcams are fixed on the traders, live streaming to an invisible online audience. There's a DJ. Welcome to Meme House, L.A. While the reality stars upstairs possess the hyper-real beauty bestowed by an Instagram filter, these traders look like regular people. But they, too, are participants in a reality show, a 24/7 live stream about themselves. The meme coin traders live in a mansion that reportedly sold 2 years back for some $18 million. The goal of the project is to turn each of these traders into what is called a KOL, or key opinion leader, an influencer who moves markets. One of the most famous KOLs was Roaring Kitty, the red headband-wearing YouTuber who made millions rallying his followers. Like Reddit's R Wall Street Beats, Wall Street Bets to invest in GameStop. What I want, says Roman Hossein, the project's elusive founder, surveying the scene, is to create 8 Roaring Kitties. Hossein is dressed in the costume of California comfort, bare feet peeking out beneath white jeans, a tan polo spun from natural-looking fiber, and on his wrist a Rolex. Hossein says he made his fortune in cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. Out in the driveway sit 2 Lamborghinis, a Ferrari F8 Tributo, and a Rolls-Royce. Everyone always says, "I wish I got into Bitcoin back in the day when everyone was making money," states Hossein. "But with meme coins, we see those kinds of returns every single week." Meme House LA and its occupants represent one of the stranger phenomena of the post-pandemic internet. The emergence of a financial ecosystem cobbled together from Telegram group chats, Discord channels, and Twitter DMs, where millions are made and lost by people who in a previous era would have had little access to or interest in the markets. It is all centered on an asset that has no clear function or utility, but it is powered by the most valuable tender on the planet, attention. With Meme House LA, Hossein is cross-pollinating 2 internet species, meme coin traders and influencers who socialize at extravagant parties featuring celebrity guests, fire dancers, and catering from Nobu. The celebrities and influencers deliver the audience. The meme coin traders provide the education, teaching young people how to make millions, betting on just about everything from their favorite Love Island couple to the enduring popularity of Labubus. If all goes according to plan, the Bel Air Mansion will be Hossein's first outpost in a network catering to this emerging audience. Meme House LA may become Meme House Miami or Meme House Dubai, he says. But for this project to take off, it needs the same brand of oxygen that everything online demands. Right now, we want eyeballs, Hossein says. We need eyeballs. Back in January, it felt like everyone was about to get really, really rich. We are in for face-melting growth, Alex Taub, the founder of the fantasy IP brand Goblin Town, who has long dabbled in cryptocurrency, tells me at the time. This is the 1990s stock market. A monkey could throw a dart at a wall of stocks and make money. And it only seemed destined to continue. The incoming president was not only crypto-friendly, he had plans to mint his own meme coin. So did the president's wife. In September, when World Liberty Financial, a crypto venture led by the president and his three sons, launched a new coin, the family's holdings surpassed $5 billion on paper. The running joke, says Taub, goes like this. You have the next 4 years to retire your entire bloodline. From the outside, it all looked too stupid to take off. Cartoon avatars shilling fart coins as a kind of currency. Bettors waging millions on whether or not a politician would wear a suit. Financial markets have always been something of a game, but they were a game for smart people, like chess. These new financial games were simpler, demanding all the intellectual rigor of Candy Crush. Being stupid actually was good. The dumber you are, the more money you make, says Taub. Still, it seemed far-fetched that these games might constitute any kind of economic viability. This is one of the largest wealth creation events for young people in history, says Zara, a 28-year-old crypto trader who lives on a cannabis farm in Northern California that she and her partner bought with their crypto winnings. Just how much money is churning through these markets is difficult to say, but in the past year, an insulated online economy has risen from a thicket of wallets and exchanges where fortunes are won and lost within a matter of minutes. On a Sunday in early August, when crypto markets were down, the leaderboard of a crypto wallet tracking website called Coalscan was topped by Payne, a trader who, as of that day, had made just over $60,000 trading meme coins. But this was nothing compared to Cupsy, a figure of legend in the world of meme coin traders, who, according to the site, had netted $1.5 million in a month. Bouts of crazed crypto-stoked frenzy have happened before, including with NFTs, and before that, ICOs. Both of those have largely fizzled out. But the formerly clunky tech powering the creation of new types of money has gotten faster, slicker. Now anyone can create a meme coin from their laptop without even a cursory understanding of a blockchain. Millions more could buy it. Sending a payment in cryptocurrency is about as challenging as ordering a t-shirt off Amazon. These markets are fueled in part by the uneasy sense that the entire economy is imploding from the inside out. Sure, things look good according to the stock market, but on the ground it feels bleak. These days, a normal job can only get you so far, and the average salary can't get you anything that really matters. Certainly not a house, and probably not your medical treatments, childcare, or college. There's a feeling that if you don't dip your toe in the game, you may not be able to afford an apartment in the future, a communications advisor at a cryptocurrency-focused venture firm, tells me. These kids and their gambling, it won't end well. The financial establishment will realize that this isn't about gambling or degeneracy. It's about so much more than that. What it's about exactly is not readily apparent from the Meme House LA trading floor, where the prospective key opinion leaders are clicking furiously between screens of rising and falling numbers. This is, in meme coin parlance, what's called the trenches. The top trader at Meme House LA is Sunny. He is middle-aged, raspy-voiced, and heavily tattooed. $100 bills circle his forearm, snaking up toward his biceps. On X, he sometimes posts about how much meme coins changed his life. "I was told after prison I would never amount to anything. The trenches changed that. Hashtag trapped to trenches," reads a recent tweet. Along with the text is a photo, a stack of 20s fanned across a keyboard with the words computer money. Sunny is monitoring a trade of a meme coin called Hunk, which bears a cartoon goose holding a bat. Sunny hopes the goose will catch on, and he'll multiply his initial investment of roughly one Solana, which on this day is worth around $160. So far, he's lost $30, but things could reverse in minutes. Part of meme coin's broad appeal is that it doesn't take much cash to get started. A typical coin launches at fractions of a cent. Catch one before it hits mainstream, and you stand to multiply your money many times over. Sunny is still reeling from another missed opportunity. "Just wait until I show you how I effed this up," he says, opening the chart for a meme coin that's a cartoon cat dressed in a fedora and a trench. Initially, he'd invested $80 when the market cap was $13,000. When the market dropped to $8,000, he pulled out. But hours later, the cat in the fedora had skyrocketed to a market cap of $600,000. Had he stayed in the trade a little longer, he would have made, he calculates the math on his phone, $3,846 off $80. Sunny got into meme coins in November when a guy he knows who racked up millions running a weed distribution center, everything legal, quit cold turkey to focus on trading meme coins full time. The guy introduced him to a group chat, and Sunny locked himself in his house for days and studied. Soon after, Sunny quit his job as a personal trainer to dedicate himself to trading. "Then I sat around, started getting chubby," he says, rubbing his belly. There are all kinds of names for what to call the new online economy of speculation: meme stocks and meme trading, attention economy, lottery economy, casino economy, the tokenization of everything, the financialization of everything. But my favorite is from an essay by an investor who writes under the byline Thysiathot on Substack. Thysiathot calls it the jackpot age, an era in which just about everyone believes that with the right amount of risk and luck, they too can get stupid rich. There is a survivor bias in crypto, where the winners are the ones telling the story, says Andy Folio, a videographer who spends some 18 hours a day leverage trading cryptocurrencies. Same with the entertainment industry. The winners are the ones on stage telling you to chase your dreams. The gamblers on Twitter are like, "Don't stop clicking." Kids these days feel the only way to make it is through gambling. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time. Make that Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.